direct from the entertainment capital of the world, fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Jerry Pippin with entertainment news, views, and interviews.
Go away, winter, spring, summer, or fall, Las Vegas has got it all.
We call the Las Vegas Strip the Street of Dreams for several reasons. When one walks down Las Vegas Boulevard, the overall ambience of the place is overpowering. It's unreal. The huge resorts lining both sides of the street and the dream-like quality of the neon at night is overwhelming. But for those of us who have worked, played, and lived in Las Vegas over the decades, the mystique of the ghost of those places that no longer exist still charge through the back roads of our mind. The Sands, the Desert Inn, the Frontier, and up the street, the old Aladdin. For a short while, way back in 1995, I lived in the penthouse of the Jockey Club. That was the condominiums across the street. Now it's gone. And even back then, when I was there, I could see that the Strip was changing, and the Jockey Club would soon be history. The Strip was morphing into an extravagant place with nothing too big to duplicate. The fountains of the Bellagio were ready to dance with the music. Every time you went down the Strip, you wondered how many high-rise buildings could be squeezed into the spaces for each of those major resorts. Unbelievable buildings cropped up around the Caesar's Palace and the Flamingo and so on and so forth. Later in the program, we're going to do some Las Vegas memories built around the Stardust Hotel, the subject of that 1995 movie Casino. We're going to be talking with Las Vegas resident Kathy Scott about the mob history of the place. And then our memories will turn to the second segment of our tribute to the Platters. The Platters made Las Vegas their home after being established in the 50s from Los Angeles as a major rock and roll soft rock group. However, before we do any of this, let's check the entertainment scene this week in Las Vegas. The big news is opening January 15th and running through January 29th. It's Tom Jones. He's at the Hollywood Theater at the MGM Grand. Tom Jones has been a sex symbol for over four decades, and he still packs them in. Here's Tom Jones to prove he's still active as a sex symbol with a song that was a recent hit in England.
Baby, take off your coat. Real slow. Baby, take off your shoes. I'll help you take off your shoes. Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can leave your hat on. You can leave your hat on. Can leave your hand on. No, all the lights. Come back here, stand on that chair. Ooh, baby, that's right. Raise your arms in the air. Now shake 'em. Give me reason to live. You give me reason to live. You give me reason to live. You give me reason to live.
You can live. suspicious minds are talking. They're trying to tear us apart.
They don't believe in this love of mine.
They don't know what love is.
They don't know what love is. They don't know what love is. They don't know what love is.
I know what love is.
Tom Jones, yeah. He'll be at the MGM Grand at the Hollywood Theater through the 29th. On the show tonight, we're going to do a lot of Las Vegas memories. I noticed, by the way, speaking of that, that the Dunes Hotel employees are having a big reunion Saturday night at the New York City Bar and Grill. That's on Spring Mountain Road. It's their 16th anniversary. The Dunes Hotel closed January 26, 1993, after Steve Wynn bought the property to put up the Bellagio. One of the main claims to fame for the Dunes was the fact that its main showroom was the first to have topless showgirls. Actually, I saw my first topless showgirl at the old Stardust back in the 60s. Coming up, we're going to take a look back at the history of this hotel, the Stardust, with Kathy Scott, well-known Las Vegas author. When you talk about the Stardust, it has a fond memory for the professional gambler. The Stardust was king for this group of people.
Gambling in Laughlin, playing a game called Pie Gal.
Yeah.
With a dealer who made it a lot of fun. He made the table fun for everyone at the table. And one day I went in to play, and he informed me it was his last shift. When I asked him why, he very proudly told me he'd been hired by the Stardust. Spent quite a bit of time with me and explained that as a dealer, the Stardust was considered the epitome of casinos, and it was an honor to be hired by the Stardust.
That was former high roller and now retired Jerry Wilhite, remembering the Stardust.
I don't think I ever really had a bad one at the Stardust. It was very professionally run.
More Stardust memories coming right up. Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at MarvelousMarv.com.
I was a hell of a handicapper, I can tell you that. I had it down so good that I ran paradise on earth. I had one of the biggest casinos in Las Vegas to run.
A little bit of the soundtrack from the motion picture Casino, the 1995 movie, about what most people say was the Stardust. Hello, welcome back to the Las Vegas Radio Show. We have Kathy Scott with us. She is a Las Vegas-based true crime writer and has written a book about the hole-in-the-wall gang, the people who ran the Stardust. Kathy, since 1958, the Stardust has been, around until they tore it down. It was quite the place. Pretty remarkable, huh? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it was something. It actually, the mob took it over, of course, but it actually grossed. But it was the largest skim, and I don't know if a lot of people know this, but it was the largest skim out of all the hotels that were being skimmed, 5-6 of them by the mob. It took in the most, or took out the most. There's supposed to be a tunnel under it.
Oh, really?
Right, for Bellatro and Lefty Rosenthal and Herbie Blitzstein and those guys, if the feds came in to, raid or do whatever they were going to do, they could escape through the basement, out a door and out a tunnel that was similar to a storm drain.
Yeah, Harry Reid had an incident there once while he's having lunch. They blew up his car.
Mr. Clean Face, Harry Reid?
Yes. He was the DA at the time there in Las Vegas.
At the Stardust, yeah. He rubbed elbows with those guys quite a bit back then.
Yeah, in fact, he basically said to them, that he was, that he couldn't be intimidated or something, and the story goes they blew up his car while he was having lunch, I guess to intimidate him. I don't know. You wrote a book, and it's called Fat Herbie and the Hole-in-Wall Gang, The Rise and Fall of a Vegas Mobster. And you've done a lot of research on that, and that's one reason we wanted you on the show to talk about. We've done shows in the past about Tony Spilotto, the enforcer, and his ice pick, and he was not a nice man.
People liked him, though. I mean, he was tough when it came to business, but actually, they liked him. His sidekick, though, however, I mean, he was his. You know, everybody called him his right-hand man, his top lieutenant, Herbie Blitzstein. And, whenever you see photos of Spilotro going in and out of the courthouse with Oscar Goodman, his attorney at the time, Herbie is always in all those photos. I mean, he sat outside the courtroom the entire time during the hole-in-the-wall gang trial in 1986-85.
Well, tell me a little bit about that trial. What was
those guys had been, it's just interesting because I'm interviewing a lot of FBI agents, former and current, but the guys who were involved in, underworld crime investigations. And, they like to say that they brought down the mob. They could not get those guys. They followed them. They surveilled them. They wiretapped their homes, the jewelry store they used as a front. And they could not get those guys for years. And they were called the hole-in-the-wall gang. I mean, Spilotro and Herbie, they were brought in to kind of make sure as enforcers that Lefty Rosenthal could continue the skim, at mostly the Stardust. At the Stardust, the money went straight to Chicago. It didn't go to Kansas City and then to Chicago. And it was a big skim. So, but on the side, they opened up the Gold Rush Jewelry Store, and it was a front for fencing.
And now, where was the jewelry store located?
On Sahara Avenue, just west of the Las Vegas Strip, close to Circus Circus, actually. You know where?
Yeah, which is not too far from Stardust.
Right, real close to the Stardust, and he actually, you know, had a store there, a gift store inside. Cilantro did. Inside Circus Circus at one point, which of course was a front. It's just a place to be that gives them an excuse to go inside so that they can watch over all the skin. But so they opened this jewelry store, and it was a front for fencing, and they were hooked up with and it was John Spilatro, Herbie Blitzstein, and Tony Spilatro, and they all from Chicago, and they had relationships with maitre d's and insurance agents, and the maitre d's would let them know, or the valets, when, you know, somebody with a big house and a big safe was having dinner, and then they'd head over to the house. Mm-hmm. They'd burglarize it, and they'd go through the ceiling, through the roof, by punching a hole or on the side. They even went so far as renting a store so they could, you know, a storefront, so they could punch a hole into the business next door, go in and burglarize. They could not get those guys for anything. And the night they finally did a bust on July 4th, 1980, 81, 80 or 81, I'm sorry, I think it was 80, they, Dan and Tony weren't there that night. They, you know, they organized it, but they weren't there. So the mob, so the Fed still couldn't get the key guys, and they got six burglars and eventually scared the bejesus out of Frank Collada, and he turned state's evidence, and that's how they got them. But it was a federal case, and but they still couldn't get them. I mean, it was the mob that finally got Spilatro, and it was on Herbie Blitzstein a year after 86, when Spilatro died. A year after that, the only thing they could get Herbie on was IRS evasion.
On tax evasion.
Tax evasion, and they had a little embezzlement maybe, but I think that was small-time stuff. And
well, you know,
getting murdered too by wannabe mobsters, but very low-level mobsters. So it was, in the end, it was the mob who got them, not the Fed.
Yeah, now when we talk about these guys, and let's get back to the Stardust a minute. It was a huge cash cow for the mob. It went to Chicago, as you said. I'd always heard about the Kansas City thing, but you say it goes straight to Chicago, huh?
Well, the other skims would go to Kansas City and then be distributed to the other families, because obviously this was an open city, you know, for other mob families besides Chicago, and they shared the wealth, so to speak. But Chicago ran it, but the skim from the Stardust went straight to Chicago. And it was, and the Feds, I don't believe, ever found out who the bag man was, who actually carried that money to Chicago. With everything they listened to and everything they did, those guys were smart. They had their own electronic surveillance inside the Gold Rush, and it took them years to get them. And then when they did, they still didn't get the key players. Herbie Blitzstein's attorney was able to get him out of the indictment, and Spilatro was still in it, and it was a mistrial. And then when in 85, 86, it was a mistrial, and it was going to go to a new trial, and Tony got dead instead.
Yeah, mysteriously turned up dead.
Turned up dead in a
Was that a traditional mafia hit?
Well, it was he and his brother were buried alive, and the only reason Michael Spilatro was killed was because he happened to be with Tony when Tony was called.
When you're called to those meetings, you're right. You're probably the guy who was thinking, well, is this going to be it, or is this a good deal? I mean, they don't know, right?
That was Herbie and Spilatro's primary task, was to control casino owners at the Stardust and the personnel, and to, you know, over the ones involved in the skim and embezzlement. But in 1984, and this is an interesting fact, in 1984, the Nevada Gaming Commission gave the highest fine ever issued in Nevada history, with a $3 million fine against the Stardust for skimming, which is major at the time.
Do you have any idea how much money they really, the mob took out of the Stardust over the years?
Well, I mean, it was in the millions.
Yeah, it had to be.
But no, I don't know the, I mean, I've heard figures, you know, being bandied about, but it was a large amount of money. Enough so that there were reports, you know, coming out of the, you know, the so-called owners, you know, of the Stardust, that they actually were losing money. They were skimming so much that the hotel was losing money, you know, but it was a very lucrative place. And
I remember some video that surfaced showing them skimming at the Stardust in a trial. Really, literally, were taking, you know, the little pieces of the pie and putting in a dish.
Yeah, one for me, or one for the hotel.
Three for me, right. Not even two, usually. who technically owned the Stardust? Do you remember?
Well, the Boyd Group didn't buy it until, what, 1980? I don't think they... I mean, it was owned by...
You know, they had some interesting people involved in it. In fact, I think a doorman at one time, Wilbur Clark down at the Desert Inn, was a doorman. And I think something very similar at the Stardust. We'll check into that.
Yeah, and I'm not... I'm sorry, I don't know who
owned. Yeah, we'll find out.
The Boyd Group has liked to keep a low profile. They don't like to... You know, it's just like the implosion, you know, is going very quietly. They're... hasn't been a lot of publicity about it, and you know it's you know there. I imagine it'll be felt throughout the valley because it'll be like a bomb going off. But it's not like they do the fanfare. I mean, when the dunes went down, he did a little documentary on it.
Oh yeah, there was a TV show built around it.
Yeah, not a very good one. But
no, it wasn't. It was just kind of thrown together.
But it was it was. You know, and the dunes, of course, and the unfortunate thing with the dunes, and it, of course, was mobbed up, too, but the unfortunate thing with the dunes was the sign, the dune sign, kind of that dewdrop or whatever, this, you know, it was a weird, weird-shaped sign. It went down with it. They imploded. I mean, it all started with the Las Vegas Country Club and the tower there, the Regency Tower, and that was in the 70s, and Spilotro had a place there. He rented it actually from from Joey Cusimano at the time, and they actually, part of the hole in the wall gang's deal was they actually burglarized homes within the Las Vegas Country Club, and they'd find out from insurance agents, you know, and then they'd go in, you know, what they had, what they were insuring.
But
that concept of living in condos is has really taken off.
Oh yeah, there you go.
High-rise condos, Turnberry, and
they're across from Circus and up from Sahara. There's a great complex.
Yeah, they're building more. They're building them on the west side of town near. There's a Suncoast Casino up here that they're building. It looks just like the Turnberry, so I'm sure Turnberry Towers, I think, has three or four, and that's near Desert Inn Road, but it's, yeah, they're doing more living and working on in sort of, they're trying to turn it into like a cosmopolitan, metropolitan area, which of course Vegas hasn't been. It used to be very Sleepy Hollow and people live in the suburbs, but they're now getting to that sort of metropolitan type city and you know, multi-use, which is what they're doing with...
Now when we talk about when we talk about Herbie, I guess let's talk about him, because that's the focus of your book, Herbie.
Well, it's the hole in the wall gang, all those guys, yeah. And yeah, Herbie and his background, yeah. Coming from the Chicago mob,
You've alluded twice that they were into burglaries, and what we would consider... I consider that kind of small town or small time stuff.
No, they got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of jewels. That was their big thing, was jewelry and cash. And people had safes, and they the richest people in Las Vegas are the ones that they were burglarizing their homes. They also got caught burglarizing a jewelry store, Bertha's jewelry store, and millions of dollars worth of jewels. And that was their, so it wasn't small time at all. And then they fenced it back in Chicago. And it sort of supplemented their scam.
So, in other words, the mob in Chicago probably got the bulk of the money from the scam. But I wonder how they divided up the others. Was it this Herbie and the rest of them, Tony's own private little nest?
Yeah, I think it was their private stash. Uh-huh. They may, and I think that's what got them in trouble, too. But, my understanding was the mob did know about it when they started, and their thing was, if you're going to do something like that, we don't want to know about it. It's separate from us.
Yeah.
And so because the heat was coming down on the Stardust, like in 1984, when the Stardust was fined $3 million, which is major at the time, and those guys were skimming, Rosenthal was skimming for Chicago, and Spilotro and Blitzstein, they were the enforcers to make sure that everybody kept in line and continued to skim. But that was 84. They got caught in the burglary thing in 81, so they had started it before that, and then the trial was 86. But yeah, the skims were, the casinos were becoming more legitimate.
Yeah, by the 90s, the mob was pretty well. I don't know that they'd be forced out. I guess they just
into other enterprises,
right?
And they're in. I mean, the Crazy Horse too.
This is a topless place. It's quite.
They were indicted. The owner for having mob ties and racketeering and the escort services, any of the skin places, the topless places. Supposedly they're mob controlled. So all they did was just change their enterprises and moved out of the casinos and into other businesses, which they've been involved in prostitution for a long time. I mean, basically the escort services are prostitution, and here in Las Vegas they are and have been very lucrative business. And you don't see, as far as the escort services, that the higher-end escorts going into hotels, big hotels on the Las Vegas Strip. I don't know. I don't see those girls being arrested. But you see a lot of street arrests of prostitutes. And I don't know, maybe it interferes with that bigger enterprise that goes in the hotels. But you can't tell me the hotel owners don't know that that's going on.
Yeah. Investigative reporter extraordinaire, Kathy Scott. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Kathy. And then we're going to talk to Gene Bennett, manager of the Platters, again, as we continue to tell the story of the Platters from Las Vegas. Don't go away. Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Marv picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Marv Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally, 928-707-0291, or visit his website, MarvelousMarv.com.
Quand on aime quelqu'un, il faut lui faire confiance. Il n'y a pas d'autre façon de faire. Il faut lui donner la clé de tout ce qui est à toi. Sinon, où est l'intérêt? Et pendant un temps, j'ai cru que c'était un mauvais.
A little bit more from the movie Casino. Welcome back to the Las Vegas radio show. Kathy Scott, a true crime author, is our guest. She's a Las Vegas resident. Kathy, how about Oscar Goodman? He was the mob's lawyer, and for probably just about as long of a time now, he's been the mayor of Las Vegas.
Well, you know, a lot of people like him, and you know, even though the drinking and his, you know, his self-proclaimed mob mouthpiece and the happiest mayor in Las Vegas, he is changing the skyline of Las Vegas. You know, he really is. I mean, buildings are going up downtown where they never did before. And you actually have a Las Vegas skyline besides the short, you know, many hotels compared with those on the Strip. So pretty soon, you know, I think downtown will be connected to the Las Vegas Strip, and it will be just one big, you know, there won't be that huge gap, you know, a mile or so before you get downtown.
I'm talking with Kathy Scott, Herbie and the Hole in the Wall Gang, the rise and fall of a Vegas mobster. We're doing this little special on the Stardust, and Las Vegas is definitely a destination now. But it's just maybe it's just because I'm an old guy. But the back there's not many of the old hotels left.
No, there aren't, and the Stardust is really, you know, the Stardust has such a storied past and played such a large role in Las Vegas that. You know, the old timers are always nostalgic when it goes down, but when a hotel like that goes down, I mean, the Hacienda, I was there for that implosion and actually went live with the BBC when it went down.
Right.
Also, people can find out about my books, you know, because I did write a Ted Binion book as well, Death in the Desert, by going to KathyScott.com, if you don't mind my plugging.
No, that's
myself.
Fine. You should do that. And we do have a link to your website. And basically, you're an old friend, and we did a lot of stuff on the Binion thing.
Yeah, you did. You really were all over that story, and thank you very much. And it turned out to, you know, be exactly what I said from the outset was it was a self-induced drug overdose and not a murder.
Yeah.
But only in Las Vegas can they turn a drug overdose into a murder. But the two people eventually, you know, the convicted, but they eventually got off, you know. A jury saw, you know, the evidence and overturned the original ruling.
Well, the history of Las Vegas is... the things of movies, really, and only it was real life.
They can't make this stuff up.
You know, this is there's never a story that Las Vegas PR people don't like. And
exactly, and especially with the Stardust, background. I mean, because they were huge involved with the mob. I mean, the mob ran the place, regardless of who the owner was. That was just the straw man owner. You know, it was really the mob running the place, and they probably don't want the history dredged up because they bought it in '84 when it was being run by the mob.
Well, but it's too good of a story not to do.
It was an important player in the history. I mean, the mob really, it was mob money that built the Strip. Mob money built the Strip, and not the big hotel owners that are coming in later. But, you know, you don't have history in Las Vegas without the mob. It's like the mob museum that the mayor wants to put down in the old post office. Beautiful old building. And we don't have many of those left in downtown. And, you know, people make fun of him. But what's wrong with a mob, with a mob museum? I mean, it was here. You can't ignore it. They built Las Vegas. So I think it's a great idea.
Well, and from a customer standpoint, if you take away the criminal element, there was not a better time for customers than when the mob owned the place.
No, there wasn't. And as far as, I mean, they weren't allowed to do murders and stuff, you know. I mean,
when I first moved to Las Vegas back here in the early 70s, people could walk the streets without any crime.
No, yeah, and everybody says, yeah, there wasn't any crime when the mob ran it, and it wasn't that they were protecting the people here. They were really protecting their own interests, but
yeah.
It was a safer place. And I mean, I did a story a while back, and I am including a chapter about this on the people who grew up with mob kids, and they were part of Little League, and I mean Tony Spilotro, you know, was part of Little League, and, you know, with his son, and they, you know, they were, they donated money and philanthropic type things, and like Susan Berman's dad, you know, was involved in the community, and, you know, I'm actually doing an update, revised edition of Murder of a Mob Daughter, and, you know, it was such a time back then. Vegas was a great place, and right now, you know, it's a lot of traffic, and it just doesn't seem to have a soul.
Well, yeah, you're right. Right. Basically, you could now go to Las Vegas. Let's say something positive about it. You could go, if you're a tourist and you've never been there before, and you could go to Las Vegas and spend 2 weeks and not see everything.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So it is. It's a destination that people need to behold to see. I mean, it's just it's indescribable, really.
Yeah.
But those times of the 50-cent breakfast and the $2 overnight chuck wagon buffet, they're gone.
Yep. Exactly.
Kathy, we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much.
Next up on the Las Vegas Radio Show, we'll get back to the business of entertaining. We're going to spotlight the Platters and their Las Vegas career with Gene Bennett, who still lives here in town. Gene has been with the Platters since the 50s. Don't go away. This is the Las Vegas Radio Show.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer, or really any time, that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over 2 decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now, on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tours.
Welcome back to the Las Vegas Radio Show. And with the magic of radio, we are instantly in Gene Bennett's office in North Las Vegas. She actually has been with the Platters since 1953. And I think probably we should pick the story up there, Gene. You had your first hit record, so what came next in 1953 for the Platters?
You were already working for Buck Ram. You had just started. And you were showing your skills, I think, as a PR person.
And I started writing the personality plugger. I was born in about 1953.
It was a newsletter.
Uh-huh. And we had this office we were renting, and he said, you know, one day he said, why don't we go out and take a look at my garage? He said, I think we can make an office out there at the house. I would save on transportation,
sure.
Your transportation and everything. I said, okay. So there's a box. When we walked in, it was a bare garage, and there was a broken box, and there was music smeared on the floor. And with legal-looking papers. And I said, Buck, what is this? This looks like your music and legal papers. He said, yeah. He said, that's my old Noble catalog. He said, I wrote songs I wrote when I was back in New York and all, mm-hmm. You know. I said, well, I'm going to take it back to the office. I'll gather it up and file it because it shouldn't be out here on a little scattered hole of the floor. He said, no, I guess you're right. So I took it back, and in doing it, I came across this lead sheet and said, only you.
Wow.
And I read the lyric, and I thought, gosh, that's good. I like that. And I showed it to Buck. I said, what about this song, Buck? That's a nice song. He said, oh, my Lord. He said, I wrote that for Bill Kinney years ago. And he said, I forgot. He said, before I could give it to him, he left the band and went back to Canada. And so it got filed away. I forgot all about it. So I said, well, I think it's a nice song. But so I laid it on the piano, and when Tony Williams, we had just met him, and he was starting to rehearse with Buck. It was about his second or third time coming. He picked up that music. He said, "What's this, Buck?" And Buck said, "That is a song I wrote for Bill Kenny years ago and forgot to give it to him before he left. Or, you know, he got away before I could give it to him." Tony said, "Let's try it." And when he walked out that night, he said, Buck said, "That's going to be the first song he records." And sure enough, we hadn't met Mercury or nothing by then. It was really brand new. And Tony, it was through Tony that we met the other three Platters, because his sister Linda Hayes was Linda Hayes.
They weren't really a group at all at that time. Just
well, they were, but they weren't with us. They were just, you know. Gunter was with them.
Oh, really?
He had started it. Cornell started the Platters originally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Herbert Reed was, I think, the last one to come in, the bass. He was. They had trouble getting him to rehearse, you know. And so they ran into a girl that was a cousin to Herbert on the street. And they said, "God, we are looking for a bass that'll stay with us. You know, we can't count on some of these guys that we've been using." And she said, "Hey, my cousin just got out of the Army. Said he was singing with that Wings Over Jordan choir." She said, "He's got a big voice, bass voice." They said, "Where is he?" You know, so she gave him the address, and they went to see Alex Hodge and Cornell Gunter went to see and meet Herbert. And he said, "Oh, he jumped at the chance to come with them." And so then, before we met Tony through his sister, Linda Hayes, and before Cornell left, and Buck was rehearsing with Tony, and he said, he wanted to be a single. I mean, she introduced him as a potential single.
Right.
And he said, Buck said, "I think you'd be better off right now with a coming trend," he said, "to be with a group." He said, "I think we should find," "you've got a great voice, and this is a good time for it, but," he said, "I think you need some voices, and it will give you a chance to get more confidence and everything, too." And Tony said, "Well, I happen to be kind of singing with some three other guys." He said, "For Ralph Bass of King Records."
Mm-hmm.
King Federal,
famous,
Federal
famous,
Records,
famous,
yeah.
Rhythm and Blues.
Yeah, they were kind of hot, but the Platters hadn't done anything yet. And so Buck said, "Well," he said, "if you want to talk to them, have them come over and we'll consider. I'll sign them. I'll sign you, all of you, if they were agreeable." So they jumped at the chance, and we signed them.
And so there you have it, folks, the inside story on one of the greatest love songs ever recorded, "Only You," by the Platters.
Only you can do make all this world seem right. Only you can do make the darkness bright. Only you and you for it's true.
Bennett, a Personality Productions, right there from the beginning with the Platters. Tony Williams, when he agreed to go with the group, the Platters, had they already settled on that name?
They had settled on the name the Platters, okay. Yeah, before Tony even got there. Herbert Reed, I don't know, Herb claims he named them, but I think it turned out that it was really kind of a joint affair. They were listening to the radio, and they were trying to figure out what to call themselves.
And back in those days, the DJ used to say spin Platters.
Yeah, he said, here's a Platter, new Platter, and everything. And Herb says he spoke up, said, why don't we name them the Platters?
So only you was the first recording?
No, they did some. Buck had done some uptunes, okay. And they were featuring David Lynch. Then, mm-hmm. And Cornell left shortly after that, so they were without a lead singer, but Ralph Bass had the idea of having uptunes, mm-hmm. And so the several things that Ralph recorded with them was managed enough that they had recorded enough that King went ahead and put out this terrible album, including the day that they tried to do Only You and nothing went right. Zola was sick. Tony was out of kilter. It just didn't come off. It was horrible. And they ended up putting it out to make their 12 tunes. You know, because Buck said, oh, God, he gave up that day. He said, we're just not going to make this today. It's terrible, mm-hmm. You know. This will never be released. He said, get rid of that. Well, they didn't. They kept it. And then I'll be darned when we got our first album on Mercury, if they didn't come out right side by side and issued a single on Federal, that horrible version. And I could just imagine all those jukebox operators where we were hanging out every Monday, you know, to sell records. Yeah, and they get all of the wrong record taken up and started on their jukebox. People say, well, that's not the Platters. Yeah. It was horrible. But
The Platters and Only You was recorded for Mercury later again. I mean, did you go back in the studio and do it again? I guess.
Oh, well, when Mercury Records, they wanted the Penguins.
Right.
Because they had Earth Angel.
Uh-huh.
And that was the only real hit they had, but they were after, and we were managing them by that time. And Buck said, well, I'll give you the Penguins on one condition. He said, what is that? He said, you have to take the Platters. And I record the Platters. So they agreed.
So it was kind of a throwaway deal for them.
Yeah, it was a throwaway deal, and it turned out
bigger than the Penguins ever thought about.
Turned out to be beyond their wildest dreams, you know. And I was counting up all the hits the other night, and how they forced, I think 8 or 9 years they had chart hits. One right after.
Yeah, I know they had a lot of number one songs. Only You, The Great Pretender. That was one of their great songs.
Great Pretender. Only You went up to number 4.
We'll be back to find out the story behind the Platters. This is fun, Gene. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're saluting the group, I guess the super group of the 50s and 60s, really. At least the 50s. The Platters. We'll be back.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
Jerry Pippin!
Welcome back to the show. We're at the office of Gene Bennett, Personality Productions in Las Vegas. And Gene, we were talking about the Platters and The Great Pretender and Only You, two of the greatest songs, really. Alan Freed, he was instrumental in making those successful too, I think. In fact, you and Alan Freed have a history.
Alan Freed had just left Cleveland when I made my first rounds, and
this is a song partner.
Yeah, Alan. Okay. Alan Freed. Yeah,
yeah, right. I mean, you when but you said you made your first rounds, yeah, you were talking to radio stations.
We started in when Only You was on the I peddled Only You on the road. My husband and I took a vacation from California and went all the way back through, and we stopped at every town, and we loaded with records, and we could go in and put them Only You.
And now that was the way they did it back in those
days.
Yeah,
oh,
literally,
yeah.
You'd go from town to town and meet the disc jockey, mm-hmm. and you didn't have to deal with a music director or program director. Yeah. If the disc jockey liked it, he could play it.
In Detroit, and the day I decided to drive down Gratiot Boulevard all by myself in our little Plymouth coupe mm-hmm. with the records.
You're right.
I got stopped, and the cop says, "Lady, you went through two red lights. I saw you. I was watching. You went through two red lights. This is on Gratiot." He said, "People don't live to go through many red lights on Gratiot Avenue here in Detroit." He said, "It's very dangerous." He said, "What are you, you know?" And I said, "Well, I said I've never driven in Detroit before. In fact, I hadn't been driving too long as it was." And he said, "Well," he said, "what are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm trying to get around to the stations, and it's so hard to try to, you know, find the stations and drive and everything." He said, "You want to take a piece of advice?" I said, "Sure." He said, "There's a parking lot right there." He said, "You swing over there and you park that car. There's a cab stand right there. And you get the cabbie and you tell him what stations you want. You've got the address. He'll take you around. You'll be back safe and sound in no time." You know, I said, "Sounds like wonderful advice to me." I knew I didn't dare not take.
Do you remember the first time the Planters played Vegas?
Oh, yes. Yes, I sure do. We got about 3 days' notice. They had a girl act that was bad, and they fired him. And they called up Buck and wanted to know if he would bring them down. And so we had to rush and make arrangements and get down there. And we got to work. It was over here at the Moulin Rouge.
Which
and they
was
were open.
A fantastic place.
Yeah.
Black operated place.
It was the
only one in
where
town.
Everybody was welcome.
Yes.
Regardless
and
of color.
And huge, huge crowds late night.
Right, right. Everybody was coming over there.
Uh-huh.
But it was only open about 6 months. And we opened it and we also closed it.
I didn't realize it was open that short of a period of time. It's such
they ran out
of
money.
History.
They ran out of money, and the strip really didn't like,
that
much.
Of course not. It was competition at that point.
And so, and it was the only one with open doors. So, but anyway, so we got paid off, and Herbie, they took all the money. They made him pay his share of the menus where they'd been eating. He always paid cash for his. He always ate hot dogs and stuff. They were eating steaks and putting it on the bill. And he had to pay half of the, bill, and he never got over it.
And he was eating cheap.
Yeah, he was eating cheap.
The rest of these guys
were
high on the hog, so to speak, as we say back in Missouri and Oklahoma.
And they sort of took and divided it up five ways and gave them, demanded they pay. But it was funny. And so Buck said, "You know what?" He says, while we're all here, he said, "I'm going to stop over and see my pal over at the Flamingo, and maybe he will let us audition for him." And that's what he did. He let him go in and let him audition. And in a matter of weeks, we were booked in on their revolving stage.
Revolving stage.
Yeah.
I've often wondered how the entertainers survived a whole set like that without being so dizzy you couldn't.
And part of the time you'd play into a blank wall because, there was
going
a part.
Round and round and round, right?
Oh, I tell you. But we played there for many weeks. And we had a gal keyboard player. She had a big bottom and she stood up to play and she wasn't very attractive. Lady D, I think her name was. Yeah. And when the entertainment director said to Buck, he said, "Gee, Buck," he said, "couldn't you have picked out a little more attractive?" He said, "Oh, wait till you hear her play. She's fantastic and everything." So when we came back, He said, "Now be sure you bring Lady D."
Yeah, right. That's the way it works.
So it worked.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Bach actually never—he's just an arranger and a manager and a writer.
Well, for many years he played saxophone.
Yeah, but I mean,
he arranged for the Dorsey Platters. Brothers, and he liked to work with singers.
Early on, did you guys feel like the Platters were the hit that the group
we felt
for?
That they would be, because Buck recognized that something in Tony's voice,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't developed at that time, but he felt that Tony had something that could be developed.
Now you left Buck Graham for a while and worked for Seymour Heller, didn't you?
No, that was I worked for them both simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
Because Buck couldn't afford to pay me in the beginning, so
so you had to have a job.
So I had to have a job. Or he said, "Why don't you go over?" He said, "I think they're looking for some part-time help." And so I went over and introduced myself to Sam Lutz and Seymour Heller. And I started working afternoons. And then a lot of evenings I worked at the other office, or in the mornings I would drop in over there. And eventually I had a full-time job there. And I helped straighten out their office, because they had a gal by the name of Dixie something. She was a fiery redhead, mm-hmm. and had a horrible shade of red hair. And when I walked in to go, when I first started that day, she said, "See that drawer down there on the left on my desk?" And I said, "Yeah." "That bottom drawer." She said, "Don't ever open it. If you hear it ringing, don't touch it." And I thought, "A drawer that rings? What kind of a thing is that?" And she pulled it open. It was a red telephone. So I'd hear it ring from time to time, but I never did, I never could figure out. But one day I walk in and Sam is sitting there, and she is working for, I'm working by then as Seymour's secretary, and we're doing busy things with Liberace, who's starting to really catch on and go across country and arranging fairs and all that kind of stuff. But Sam, he had Dixie, and I go in there, and he's sitting with his head in his hands, and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Dixie's not coming back." "What the hell am I going to do?" I said, "Well," and his desk was a total mess, had always been, and never, He said, "Look at my desk." He said, "I'm afraid to let anything go, because I never see it again." The files, there was a bank of files in her office, and they were stacked to the ceiling with stuff that was unfiled. I said, "Why don't you let me file some of this?" "Oh, no, I'll just leave it. I'll take care of it." So she finally, she was a bookie, evidently. She must have been booking.
That's what the red phone must have been.
That was what the red phone must have been, and she got into trouble. She probably spent some of the money or something, and she was on the lam. And so I helped Sam, and we also had a double entry set of books that we set up, because they had was working with single entry, and I thought, man, that's going to have to go someday, that's for sure. And I walked in there one morning, auditors was all over the place, and then they enlisted me to help with that. So I had a busy job the first through most part of 52 and early 53.
On the next installment, Jean Bennett will talk about her career with Liberace. And, of course, we'll get back to the Platters. I'm Jerry Pippin.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine.
Ah, Liberace. Another batch of Las Vegas memories. That's our show for this week. Thank you for listening. Jane Swartley and Glenn Pitts have been our technical advisors. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. Cheers.
But I'll be seeing you.